Welcome to the new State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind.
I'm Joseph Pache.
And I'm Grace Wan. This is your weekly conversation about where we live
and what matters most. We are live.
And we are local.
Every Monday night.
Right here on KALW. Welcome to the State of the Bay. I'm Joseph Pache. On tonight's show, we'll be hearing about groundbreaking medical research going on right here in the Bay Area. Then we'll interview co-director Betsy West on her new documentary, My Name is Pauli Murray, the story of a non-binary black lawyer, activist, and poet. But first, let's check in with San Francisco public defender Manu Raju, who recently sued the California Superior Court system. Welcome to State of the Bay.
It's Manu. Thank you. Thank you for having me, Joseph.
Thank you. So at a rally in September, you announced that your office was filing a lawsuit against California Superior Court because of trial delays that you believe violate the federal and state constitutions. Tell us more about the problem and what you hope to achieve.
Well, the problem is a dire one, Joseph. We have a real, human rights and constitutional crisis here in San Francisco. The speedy trial is a right under the 6th and 14th Amendments to the Constitution, and that right is guaranteed not just here, but in virtually every part of the world under the Universal Human Rights International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, provides that everyone shall be entitled to trial without undue delay. What we have in San Francisco right now is over 100 people sitting in jail with days that were in the past where their trial should have been conducted, and we have hundreds more awaiting their trials out of custody. It's a dire situation, and something needs to be done immediately.
So is the issue here that you're trying to address something that the pandemic created, or is this a systemic problem that predated it?
It's a problem that became much more exacerbated during the pandemic. What happened is the Judicial Council gave the courts a reason because of the pandemic to push trials down the road. My office was really adamant that we really need to have those trials now because nothing happens positive usually from delay. And what's going on right now is the city's opened up. People are in restaurants, people are in cafes, people are going to movies, but freedom has taken a back seat. And there's not a single felony trial happening right now in San Francisco, and the courtroom doors were locked. The justice cannot happen when defenders who are trying to vigorously defend our clients do not get an open courtroom. What I said at the rally, which I'll repeat again today, is, I think the most oppressive thing that a state can do is to take away an individual's freedom and simultaneously deny that individual and his or their team the ability to win that freedom back, which is, and what we need for that is a courtroom and jurors.
So you,
and a meaningful deadline.
Right. And so you mentioned that there are over 150 people who are in jail and 400 people in total who've been waiting for their trials to begin for over 2 months. How are the people who are awaiting their trials managing the unknown here, the uncertainty about when their trial will come to court?
It's really, really challenging and painful for them. I mean, we've gotten letters and, our clients are telling us about, being diagnosed with asthma, being diagnosed with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. One of them just wrote about being on lockdown repeatedly for up to 14 days at a time. People who are really worried about their, grandmother outside and wanting to take care of them and see them before they pass away, people not being able to see their children, people being in circumstances where they can't leave their cell for 23 hours of the 24 hours a day. So it's very challenging. And as defenders, we'd like to tell people, listen, don't take this deal. I'm going to fight for you and I'm going to go to court. But it's very difficult to have that conversation when you don't know when that court date is going to be. And you're telling your client to hold on into some unknown date in the future. We just had a client who came down for trial thinking this is his last day for trial. And the judge told him, come back in February of 2022. it's just an untenable situation.
And that's someone who's actually free until their trial. But you're talking a moment ago there about those who are not, those who are in custody, and sounds like they are in situations that are pretty untenable.
Right. Oh, I was just talking about someone who was in custody.
Oh, okay.
Told come back in 5 months.
Oh, come back literally to the courtroom, not to – okay.
Yeah, sorry. When I say come back, I mean come down from your jail cell in 5 months.
Got it. Got it. And you said something there a moment ago that you're trying to work with your clients and tell them not to accept a deal and to hold on. Say more about that.
Sure. It's common in our practice, and it's really important for defenders to be able to – in fact, I was just talking to a colleague about this literally an hour ago who was rushing to finish this motion because he's being offered a deal to plead guilty to a strike and to go home. And the attorney looking at the evidence thinks, no, he's not guilty of the strike. He should really go to trial. But it's one thing to have that conversation where you can say, listen, your trial is going to start no later than 3 weeks from today. It's another thing to have that conversation when you have no idea when that trial is going to start. And that's, in general, a challenging part of our practice. Pretrial detention and what we call overcharging or upcharging are part of sort of the, unfortunately, has become the fabric of the criminal legal system in this country. But when we at least have the tools of the investigation, we can do the evaluation of the case, the truth that we can elicit through cross-examination, and a place to do that, to show a jury that, then we can try to fight against that. But when that is taken away from us, that's the only leverage we as defenders have in the system to bring about justice for our clients and their families. And that's why it's tragic right now that we're in a situation where we don't have that forum.
So while people are in custody, they're having to weigh what it means to sit for a extended period of time, not knowing exactly when their case is going to come before a judge and a jury, and versus pleading to to something, maybe a lesser charge, in order to get out, when that's not necessarily what the evidence would show or what you as their counsel would recommend.
Exactly, and I think what. It's important that the listeners understand about the system is that the window to the case initially starts with a police report. But based on the work that we do, the extra investigation that we can do, the other facts that we can elicit through cross-examination, perhaps a psychological evaluation, we can present a much different picture than that which initially appeared the police report, the asking the questions of witnesses that perhaps the police didn't ask them. We can present a much radically different picture, but no one's going to look at that picture seriously unless a judge says, I'm sending this case out to trial and it's going to start on this day. Then what we find is prosecutors may look more seriously at the case, and we get that opportunity to really fight for freedom for our clients in the courtroom. But we need Again, we need that open courtroom, and we need a meaningful last day to do that.
So what are the things that are getting in the way of this happening, of things speeding up, of there being trials that happen closer to what is allowed by law or required by law, I should say?
Well, that's a better case for a question for the courts. We don't see a meaningful reason. We think it should be all hands on deck. We think every courtroom in the building in 850 Bryant and the Civic Court House should be opened up for criminal trials, and frankly, other places. We'll try cases anywhere. We'll go to the Moscone Center. We'll go to gymnasium. We'll do it on Dolores tennis courts. Wherever we can do it, a space, we'll try cases. But there has to be a priority from the courts of providing our clients the space to fight for freedom, which they should be entitled to under international human rights law and under our Constitution.
So how many criminal jury trials have actually taken place this year in 2021 in San Francisco?
In 2021, there's been let me get you an exact number here. There's been 14 felony trials tried so far in this entire year. And there's only been about three in custody, felony trials. When I say in custody, with the client in custody, since the reopening on June 28th of 2021. And by rate of comparison, I mean, there was a few years ago, we were able to try 80 felony trials in 1 year. And I also want to say that it's not just the trials that happen, it's also having that last day in that open courtroom forces the prosecutor and the judges to look more seriously at the case. Without that, there's no real incentive to do that. So it's a combination of both of those that are really just devastating for the communities that we represent.
I wanted to go back to the story that you told of someone who was telling you that they've been in their cell for 23 hours a day. What's that about? Is that due to COVID? Is there something else going on here? Why are your clients experiencing this?
Yeah, what we've been told is that that's due to COVID, and you know, that's the reason we've been given by the sheriffs. But and that's all the more reason that the courts, frankly, we'd like to see courts trying to push the send cases out early because they know the conditions are different in jail now than they previously were.
And so, what if, you know, the sheriff were here with us tonight and says, you know, the situation is dire. We don't have enough staffing. We don't have, you know, it's dangerous given COVID. What you mentioned a few things that you would put forth as solutions. How do you balance some of those concerns?
Well, I think, you know, in this moment, I think when you get to know individuals and the clients that we represent, and I often think this, if the general public can go in and just meet some of the people, even the ones accused of relatively serious crimes, and said, should this person be in custody pending their case? If they got to know them, they would say, no, absolutely not. I now see this person. They're actually not a danger. What we need to be doing is releasing way more people while their, you know, cases are pending, if we can't get the speedy trial. But more importantly, even for people out, just the anxiety of having a case over your head, the potentially electronic monitoring or e-carceration, that has its own impact on people. It interferes with people's employment, it interferes with housing, and it interferes with the ability to plan meaningfully for the next several weeks or months of their life. It interferes in so many different ways that, you know, the speedy trial right is really is preeminent and needs to be honored for us to be able to get any sort of justice in the system.
What kind of response have you gotten to the suit?
Well, they haven't talked to me directly. As you know, I'm a plaintiff in the suit. We haven't seen trials getting sent out. We've heard that in other counties, they're moving pretty rapidly to try to deal with this potential issue, but we haven't seen movement here. I'm hoping that in the next day or so, or certainly the next few days, I'm hoping that I'm going to see 20 cases sent out to trial.
I wanted to ask about whether the DA's office is contributing to this lag. The Examiner reported that the Superior Court Judge Bruce Chan recently said in open court that the DA's office, quote, concerns themselves with the unglamorous yet necessary work of public prosecution. It's time to really take care of business at home instead of thinking about the national or state stage. And according to the DA, Judge Chan called to apologize for those remarks. But do you think that the DA's office is somehow contributing to this lag in speedy trials?
Well, the reality is that, you know, from what we've seen is that, I mean, and this dates from my days across different counties, they are opposing our motions to dismiss the case or our motions to for release. But generally speaking, prosecutors will tend to use the delay to avoid like really getting into preparing and, you know, looking at the case as seriously as it should be. And but that's, as I said before, that's a structural issue. We have to realize that the focus on the prosecutor's office too often in their role is actually misplaced because their only lens in the case often is through the police report. It's the defenders who will bring out the other witnesses, who will maybe ask the other questions, who will bring the fuller picture of the case. And that's why, you know, we don't want a situation where we're saying, oh, the prosecutor should deal with the situation ahead of time. We want a case where we get our jury courtroom and our jury trial so that we can really pursue justice in that way. And that's really the solution that we need.
And if you don't see the kind of action you're hoping for in the next couple of weeks, as you mentioned, what's your next step here?
Well, I think one important thing and what we're asking everyone to do is to put on public pressure. You can go to our website. You can sign a petition. You can talk to your neighbors about this. You can tweet about it. Use social media. I mean, this is a crisis, and it's something it's you know, if the majority of our clients weren't impoverished Black and brown people, there'd be a lot more attention on this issue. But the reality is because of race and class dynamics, there's not nearly as much attention given to this as there should be. And we want that, that public focus on this issue.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you for joining us, Mano Raju. Did I get it right?
Yes, you did.
All right. You're San Francisco's public defender. Thanks for joining us, and good luck.
Thank you so much, Joseph. Appreciate you.
Coming up next. On State of the Bay, we'll hear about groundbreaking medical discoveries from Bay Area doctors Alan Goh and Deepak Srivastava. That's right after the break. Stay with us. Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Joseph Pache. With its robust biomedical community, it's no surprise that local research institutions have played a part in researching how to tackle COVID-19. To talk about their cutting-edge research, we are joined this evening by Dr. Alan Goh, a professor in epidemiology, biostatistics, and medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and the regional medical director of Kaiser Permanente's Northern California Clinical Trials Program. Welcome, Alan Goh.
Thank you very much, Joseph.
And we're also joined by Dr. Deepak Srivastava, a pediatric cardiologist and the president of the Gladstone Institutes, a state-of-the-art biomedical research institution in San Francisco's Mission Bay. Welcome, Deepak Srivastava.
Thank you very much. Great to be with you.
And we want you, our listeners, to be part of this conversation. We're going to be talking about how Bay Area doctors and scientists are helping the global fight against COVID. Are you curious to hear about the latest research? Give us a call. We're at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at stateofthebay@klw.org or send us a message on Twitter. We're at State of Bay. So the news is full of studies from around the world trying to solve the mysteries of COVID-19. And actually, the lead-in to our program tonight, The Daily from The New York Times, is talking about how ivermectin is still out there as a theory. But let's talk about the cutting-edge research going on right here in our own backyard. So, Alan Goh, we have been understandably focused on how to prevent COVID, and the treatment of COVID has perhaps maybe gotten less attention because there just hasn't been as much robust progress in that area. And your group has studied remdesivir, one of the most commonly used drugs to treat COVID. Tell us now, many months into the COVID epidemic, that what you've learned about remdesivir's efficacy now that you've had time to reflect on it.
Yeah, thank you, Joseph. I think that it was both pressing and exciting to try to contribute at that time by helping to conduct the clinical trials to evaluate remdesivir, both among people who were admitted to the hospital as well as the less severe patients and out in the outpatient world. And I think we've learned that it is certainly one of the things that can be used, although maybe not as effective as we had hoped in the beginning.
And so where does that leave doctors at the bedside now when they're trying to treat someone with a COVID infection?
So I think that given the current trials, we definitely have certain options that can be provided to people who are ill enough to be admitted to the hospital, things like steroids, remdesivir, and also some of the monoclonal antibodies. I think one of the most important things now is to try to identify effective therapies when people are less sick, when they first get diagnosed as an outpatient, for example, with COVID-19, where we can try to keep them from progressing to more severe illness.
And that, my understanding in that area, monoclonal antibodies have been studied. What have we learned about that?
Yes, in general, they haven't been particularly effective, although recent data suggests that a combination of them might be helpful in certain combined monoclonal antibodies. And also, there are some new antiviral oral pills that was just released that might also be an effective for people who are initially mild disease. And there are a number of different things that are continuing to be evaluated, and we look forward to the ones that could be given in a pill form rather than requiring an IV infusion.
So why do you think it's been so elusive, a treatment, a really robust treatment for COVID? Why has it been so elusive when we were able to come up with vaccines in such short course?
I think that's an excellent question. I think vaccines, of course, have a long history, and we've been very, very successful to be able to identify multiple vaccines. I think treating viruses when you have the infection already has always been a challenge in the medical field, to try to find something where you can time it just at the right time and to the right patient, because viruses are very elusive in the way that they act biologically. And they affect people differently. So I think that is part of it. And because they also mutate, unlike certain other kinds of infectious agents, they can evade a lot of our defenses and our therapies.
Hence the Delta variant and the question about whether, you know, people need boosters or not. So similarly in the situation when it comes to actually finding medications that will treat people who are actively infected.
Yes. And also, I'd say that even though the medical field has done a very good job in clinical trials, one of the challenges was to be able to enroll a large number of people very quickly at the start of both the pandemic and then subsequent surges.
And what have you seen there? Have there been enough participants in these trials?
I think that we've gotten a lot better at doing them. I think part of that is both healthcare delivery systems and academic centers working together to be able to identify people much more quickly and earlier in their disease by identifying positive tests and reaching out to people and being able to develop the kinds of clinical trial protocols where people can be able to enroll remotely and don't have to necessarily come into the hospital to get treatment, but where we can actually get the medications out to them, to their home, because they have COVID and can begin to test the therapies at home.
Wow. All these unforeseen challenges until this moment. Merck announced last week that it had come up with an antiviral pill, the first oral medication for COVID-19. And I'm going to try to pronounce it. Molnupiravir. Is that how you say it? Molnupiravir?
That's close enough.
Close enough. Yeah. So tell me how it's pronounced. No. Tell me what you know about this drug and how is it different or similar to remdesivir?
So it's a different class from remdesivir, but it is really part of a set of strategies to attack the virus, either common things about viruses or things that might be specific to COVID-19. And what's unique about it is that it is a pill, and that they actually tested it rigorously. And that's where I think it's encouraging to see that trial result. And I think we're going to hope to see additional studies of that particular drug, as well as other antiviral agents, both singularly and in combination in people with COVID-19. Again, particularly people who tend to have milder disease, to see if we can prevent them from getting sicker.
So this does raise the question of whether the approach is going to have to be multifaceted, and that whether just one pill or one mode of attack is not going to be enough here. But we don't know yet, right? We have to see kind of how things go.
That's exactly right. And also, I think one of the key things is to be able to identify people very quickly and again, test one as well as a combination of treatments in these different groups of people to see who benefits most from what approach.
All right. So I want to pause for a moment and reintroduce the program. This is State of the Bay on local public radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco, Bay Area. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing how Bay Area scientists are understanding COVID-19 and developing treatments as we are continuing in this pandemic. So We want to hear from you. What questions do you have about treatments for COVID-19 and in general about where we are in this pandemic? We are welcome to join our conversation by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Excuse me. Or find us on Twitter. We're at State of Bay. So staying with you, Alan Goh, with over 4.5 million patients in Northern California Kaiser system, you have access to a lot of data. And so tell us how you've been able to use that data and what you've learned from it in terms of understanding how people are experiencing COVID, how that's changing, and other clues or other enlightenments that you've been able to find.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think that there's a couple things I'll say up front. I think the Kaiser Permanente invested in an integrated electronic health record system. So that goes across our hospitals, our emergency departments, our outpatient clinics, and that allows us to collect essentially a lot of information about people when they get care with us here in Kaiser Permanente. And using that information, or even early in the pandemic, we were able to begin to predict where the next surge was going to be, to help hospitals adjust to anticipated rise in the number of people being admitted for COVID so they could plan better for staffing, and to begin to give people who are at risk better information about their underlying risk of developing COVID-19, as well as the complications of COVID-19.
And my understanding as well is that while people were coming in with COVID-19, lots of people who had other illnesses, both chronic and new illnesses, weren't coming in for fear of COVID-19. What are you seeing now in terms of the fallout from people staying away from the hospital or from their doctor's offices?
You're absolutely right. So early in the first surge, we noticed that there are fewer people being admitted to the hospital for a heart attack and also for stroke. And certainly that was related to the lockdown, as well as the concern about getting COVID-19 when they came to the hospital. And so in addition to making sure that we went out to our membership and reassured them of the safety procedures we were putting in place, we also wanted to make sure that we identify high-risk patients. And the good news is that in subsequent surges of COVID-19, we did not see the hospitalization rate drop off for heart attack and stroke. So I do think that it was reassuring that people were beginning to feel more comfortable that if they needed emergency care, they could get it safely within our medical facilities. And I think we've now seen that in other places as well, outside of Kaiser Permanente. So I think the message is getting out that if you need emergency care, you need to get to the emergency department and call 911, and you're going to be taken care of safely.
So, Deepak Srivastava, I wanted to bring you into the conversation because the Gladstone Institutes are also trying to understand COVID-19 and pivoted much of its research labs to focus on better understanding this virus. And you're making new discoveries in terms of detection and treatment and prevention. Why don't you, in turn, walk us through what you're doing in each of those areas?
Great. Thank you, Joseph. Yeah, at the Gladstone Institutes, we always had a great group of world-class virologists, but also scientists who study the brain, the heart, and the immune system, all of which are affected by COVID. And so they really, all these folks are under one roof, and they teamed up quickly to really tackle this. And, you know, one of the things that the world still needs 18 months into the pandemic is a really good way to test for COVID that's efficient and cheap and fast. And right now we have antigen tests, they call them, which are actually very fast, 15 minutes. They're relatively inexpensive, but they're not very sensitive, meaning if you don't have symptoms, they aren't really so good for telling you if you might be carrying it or not. And on the other side, we have these tests that are known as PCR tests that are very, very sensitive, but they're expensive. And it still is taking about 24 hours on a good day to try to get those back. And so that PCR test requires, part of the reason it takes longer is you have to amplify the number of copies that are present in the nose, and that's why it's so sensitive. And so we tried to fill that gap that I think people still need so they can test themselves at home, maybe even every day or at a sporting event or at a workplace. And we've solved how to do that. We're using this machinery called CRISPR that many people have heard about, perhaps related to editing our genome, that was discovered right here in the Bay Area by Jennifer Doudna, who's at UC Berkeley and also at the Gladstone Institutes. And that technology we've adapted so that it can directly detect the presence or absence of the virus in a nasal swab without having to amplify it at all. So whatever few copies are there, we can tell if it's there, and it can read out on your cell phone. And so as a result, it's very fast, within 15 minutes, easy, cheap. So you could, you know, maybe $5 to $10, you could do it every day if you wanted. And it's almost as sensitive as a PCR test. So that is one area where I think we can make a big impact as we develop that test.
And how soon do you think that's going to be available on the market?
Well, we're just in the process of getting being able to, hopefully by the end of this fall, to really get enough test results from actual patients to be submitting it for approval and then manufacturing. So it's still a few months away, but it all seems to be working really well.
And how does this compare to, you know, at the airport now, you can pay, I don't know, $250 and get what is called a rapid PCR, where the results are ready in 30 minutes. That doesn't sound too bad. 15 versus 30. Is that really as good as the PCR that we've been relying on all this time? Or yeah, how is that possible?
Yeah. So when the pandemic started, it was sort of a dream that we could get to that level of sensitivity. It's similar to PCR, but it wasn't easy. So it's taken a lot of hard work to refine the method. And in fact, using a lot of data science and artificial intelligence to try to get at the right combination of methodology to get it to a point where it's now very close to PCR sensitivity. And in fact, many people think that the PCR is almost too sensitive. You can still detect the virus even when people are no longer sick and even weeks out. So I think that's a big benefit. It won't be $250. It'll be faster than even the rapid PCR at the airports. And ideally, people will be able to have this kit in their own home because it involves a single step. And so anybody should be able to do this without any special training.
So in my earlier part of this conversation with Alan Goh, we talked about how, you know, the drug development pipeline has not been as robust and been a little bit disappointing. So tell us about what the Gladstone Institutes is doing in the way of studying treatments for COVID.
Yeah, one of the benefits at Gladstone is, as I mentioned, under one roof, we have these scientists studying all these different organs that are affected by COVID. And we have the ability to do that in human cells that we can make from human stem cells. And so very quickly, all our scientists collaborated, and we were able to figure out what the virus is actually doing in human cells to cause the damage. And we were able to take it a step further and figure out how the viral proteins actually hijack the proteins of our own cells to take over our cells and turn them into their own factory, if you will, to make lots of themselves. And we very quickly were able to understand all the different proteins that the virus takes over within our cells. And we are now looking for ways to drug those interactions so that the virus is unable basically to take over our cells. And in particular, one of the areas we're really excited about is one of the features that causes so much trouble in COVID is people develop these clots in their lungs, throughout their body, and they're fibrin in nature. And one of our neuroscientists actually had been studying fibrin in multiple sclerosis, and she found that in collaboration with our virologist that the spike protein that everybody's heard about on the surface of the viral protein actually interacts with fibrin, which is a key part of our clotting machinery. And so we think that this spike protein interaction with fibrin is actually what's leading to all this clotting damage. And in fact, she had already developed an antibody for multiple sclerosis to block that fibrin. And we're now testing that to see if that same antibody could be used in COVID patients to prevent this clotting and a lot of the lung damage that we see there also.
So, Alan Goh, I want to go back to you now to talk a little bit more about what you're actually seeing clinically in terms of the ravages of blood clots from COVID infection through your clinical work or your databases in Kaiser of Northern California. So you've studied this area. And tell us, what are you seeing?
Yes, we have. So we were able to actually look across all of Kaiser Permanente in California, so both in Northern California and Southern California, and we were able to use our electronic health records to demonstrate that patients who were hospitalized with COVID-19 were at much higher risk for developing particularly venous clots, so in the legs and other extremities, as well as pulmonary embolism, which is a blood clot into the lung that Deepak mentioned. And on top of that, that this risk doesn't just end when they're in the hospital, even when they get out, that risk continues to stay even through the first month that they've had COVID-19. And this, in addition, we are able to identify different risk factors that if you have COVID-19, put you at higher risk for developing that as well. So I think that's important, again, to help identify who might benefit from more intensive prevention strategies. We then took that and helped work with other groups in terms of participating in a clinical trial where we could identify people and see if we could use a commonly known blood thinner to see if it will work to reduce the risk of those clots before they even get to the hospital.
Wow. And say a little bit more about what you saw. It seems like not everyone is equally at risk for these blood clots.
That's right. So, you know, we know that it isn't, you know, the same risk for every patient with COVID-19. So, for example, patients who are older, those who had a previous blood clot, people who were a self-reported Black race, as well as people who were more overweight or obese, were more likely to develop blood clots if they unfortunately experienced COVID-19. And the way we were able to demonstrate that was by looking at a very large number of people over several of the surges so that we could get a representative group of people who were, you know, identified quickly within Kaiser Permanente to have COVID-19 and then follow them throughout that next 30 days to see who did or didn't develop a blood clot. In addition, we found that if you developed a blood clot, it was actually pretty similar type of blood clot if you developed it with COVID-19 or you developed it outside of having COVID-19. It's just that there are far more in those who had the infection.
And do you think that the incidence of blood clots in these individuals puts them at risk for blood clots down the road, or once the COVID's gone, the risk is back to whatever it would have been?
Now, that's an outstanding question, which I don't think we really know, but we're currently in the process of looking at recurrent blood clots to see if it is the same in people with and without COVID-19 to try to address that. Because as you're alluding to, it could definitely change our strategies for how long we might want to treat someone, again, with a blood thinner to try to prevent them from having the complication of blood clots.
So I'm going to reintroduce the program. This is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Joseph Pache, and we're talking with Dr. Srivastava and Dr. Goh, Dr. Srivastava of Gladstone Institutes and Dr. Alan Goh of Kaiser Permanente about their research into COVID, both at the bedside and at the bench, as it were. If you have a question for our scientists, our local scientists here, you can give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org or find us on Twitter. We're at State of Bay. So I have a few listener comments I wanted to go through here. So we have an email from Anne saying, Peter Walter at UCSF has a spray technology that protects people from COVID. Do you know what the latest is on that innovation? Either of you want to take that question?
Sure. Melanie Ott, who's one of our head of our virology group here, actually worked with Peter Walter in developing that nasal spray. And it's still in development, but in animals, it looked very promising. And we are developing also another method to make short fragments of what we call peptides that we can also be sprayed in there that could do something similar. So I'm very excited about that as a prevention approach to protect people in addition to the masks and other things.
And we have another listener from Marin who writes, I thought it was the J&J vaccine for COVID that was what was causing all the blood clots. Am I more likely to get a blood clot, I guess, from the vaccine or actually from getting COVID? So this is to you, Dr. Goh.
Thank you. That's an important question. You're definitely more likely to get it with COVID-19 than the J&J or any of the other vaccines, for sure. It's really part of the, as Deepak mentioned, it's unfortunate, but this particular virus does change the way that our blood clotting system works and puts people at a much higher risk for developing that, completely separate from the rare risk of blood clotting in certain patients getting certain vaccines.
So Deepak Srivastava, back to you. We talked about what Gladstone Institutes is doing in terms of detections and treatments. How about prevention? I understand that you're working on a new vaccine.
Yes, we're working on a completely different approach for vaccination. And the vaccines that have been developed are actually wonderful and safe. But we've seen the problem of trying to get 7 billion people in the world vaccinated quickly without having variants come up. So an alternative approach that we had actually started for vaccinating people with HIV basically took a completely different approach where we tried to maintain the virus's ability to make more copies of itself and spread from cell to cell, but essentially neutered it so that it couldn't do anything bad. And we were able to do that for HIV, and that is entering a clinical trial next year. And we tried to do something similar for COVID-19 and have in fact been able to create these what we call therapeutic interfering particles that basically are particles of the virus, pieces that interfere with the normal virus's ability to cause damage. Because they don't have the ability to damage our cells. And that is appears to be, we think maybe is working in animals, and we're trying to move that forward quickly to try to advance it. And it actually, if a virus is mutating in this system, I won't go into the details, but it has the ability to sort of change with the virus, which is really clever. And so we think that there's always a battle going on between the virus and our cells, and the virus gets to change so much more quickly than we do that it often wins. And that's what we saw with the Delta variant and hope may see with another. But in this system, we think we can empower our cells to keep up that battle and maybe have a fair playing field.
And how do you see this vaccine living alongside the vaccines we already have? Do you see it having a specific niche or taking over the strategies that we currently have?
Well, you know, I think for this, or we are also always thinking about the next pandemic, because I think what we've learned in this century is that this is probably not the last one. You know, being able to design something that actually can keep up with the virus, and I didn't mention, has the potential to spread from person to person, much like the oral polio vaccine did, and that's how we were able to eradicate polio. It carries with the fact that it could do that, carries a number of ethical issues with it about it, consent and spreading from person to person, that we'd have to work out. But I think the power of this is that you could immunize a much larger population quickly, more quickly, which when you think about the whole world is actually, you know, really the key.
Wow. Considering all of the divisiveness we have these days around virus, around how to deal with the virus, whether it's masking or with vaccines, this idea of inoculation spreading from one person to another, that I imagine will take a lot of talking through, to say the least.
Yeah.
How does that work? That's just fascinating. How does that actually work? Is it very similar to how the oral polio vaccine works?
It is a bit, except here. So the oral polio vaccine was a vaccine that you could create basically a small infection, and it then would be contagious. But it never did anything bad to those people who got it. And in the same way here, the virus is neutered, as I mentioned, so it can make copies of itself, and it can leave the cell and go to another cell or potentially another person. So it has a lot of similarities to the oral polio vaccine in that way.
And may I ask how it's actually passed on from person to person?
It would be through the respiratory system.
Got it. Okay. Wow. That was pretty amazing there. So in the last minute or so that we have left on this segment, and there's so many more discoveries to talk about, but this was the COVID piece was so rich. So we'll have to have you back to talk about this more. Where do you see the next 6 to 12 months going? Let's start with you, Alan Goh.
Yes, I think that we are going to continue to refine additional vaccines, resolve the issues of optimal boosters. And I think there's still going to be a number of therapies to be discovered, either new treatments or reused therapies that have been used in other indications to help us ultimately get a much better handle on COVID-19.
And Deepak Srivastava, I don't know, do you think in 6 to 12 months or do you think much further out?
I think in both. And I think my hope is that in 6 to 12 months, we will have this fast, cheap, easy way to test. And everybody can do that in their workplaces and homes. And I think, as Alan said, now that we'll have understood how this virus works, we will have very directed treatments rather than repurposing old treatments for this, which is so far what we've done. But we'd have very specific treatments for this virus. And I think we've got to, as a society, everything we're doing now, we've got to think about not just COVID-19, but how do we prepare ourselves to more quickly battle and not lose 700,000 people when the next pandemic hits.
Amen. Well, I want to say thank you to both of you, Alan Goh of UCSF and Kaiser Permanente of Northern California, and Deepak Srivastava of the Gladstone Institutes. Thanks for your groundbreaking work, and we look forward to hearing more of your breakthroughs in the coming months.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, we'll hear Ethan Elkind's interview with co-director Betsy West about her new documentary, My Name is Pauli Murray. Want to learn more about this social justice pioneer? Stay tuned. This is State of the Bay. Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Joseph Pache. Next, we'll hear from Betsy West, co-director of My Name is Pauli Murray, the new documentary looking at the life and ideas of Pauli Murray, a non-binary black lawyer, activist, priest, and poet. A civil rights trailblazer, Murray challenged race and gender discrimination, laying the foundation for Brown versus the Board of Education and influencing the work of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and other legal icons.
My name is Pauli Murray, and my field of concentration has been human rights. My whole personal history has been a struggle to meet standards of excellence in a society which has been dominated by the ideas that blacks were inherently inferior to whites and women were inherently inferior to men.
So you've just heard the voice and words of Dr. Anna Pauline Murray, or Polly Murray, as she went by. And that was a clip from the new documentary, My Name is Polly Murray, which is now streaming on Amazon Prime Video. And I'm so pleased to be joined by Betsy West, co-director of the film. Thank you so much for joining us on State of the Bay, Betsy.
Thank you, Ethan. Happy to be here.
So, Betsy, tell me about Polly's remarkable life and what drew you to the story.
Well, you summarized some of Polly's accomplishments there, but what really drew my directing partner, Julie Cohen, and I was what we learned from Ruth Bader Ginsburg when we were making our documentary, RBG. Because in the early 1970s, when Ginsburg was writing her first brief before the Supreme Court arguing for gender equality, she put Polly Murray's name on the cover of that brief. Not because Polly had actually co-written it, but really to give credit to Polly for coming up with the innovative, I mean, in a way, radical idea in the 1960s to use the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment to win gender equality. So after RBG was finished, Julie and I were talking like, who is this Polly Murray? And we started looking into Polly's story and frankly were absolutely blown away by the scope and importance of Polly's life. And we really wondered, like, why did no one teach us about Polly Murray?
So Polly Murray is not a household name. I'm guessing most of our listeners have never heard of Murray before this interview. So why has so much of Polly's work and contributions to American society gone unrecognized?
Well, first of all, I have to say it's not as if no one recognized Polly Murray. You know, there have been feminist scholars and historians and primarily, frankly, female African-American scholars who have been pointing up Polly's contributions and done amazing work. And in recent years, as people have discovered Polly's struggle with gender identity, I think the LGBTQ community has become a little more aware of Polly. But in the general world, you're right. And there are a bunch of reasons, but I think you could narrow it down to sexism, certainly in the civil rights movement, of not necessarily recognizing all of the contributions of women, and racism in the women's movement, not recognizing the contributions and the needs of African American women. And perhaps Polly's own reticence in putting themselves forward at a time when, you know, Polly had a female partner, and that was dangerous at that time. I mean, you can lose your job in the 1950s and the 1960s, and, you know, that may have pulled Polly back a little bit.
Well, let's talk about Polly's accomplishments, because it's really amazing how involved and how enmeshed Polly was in the broader civil rights movement of the 20th century. So can you go through essentially Polly's greatest hits? And I know there's a lot and they're very eclectic.
I know, Ethan, there's so much. Okay. First and foremost, Polly Murray refused to sit in the back of the bus in 1940, which is 15 years before Rosa Parks. I mean, Polly was not the only person to try to fight segregation laws, but that was pretty unusual at the time. Polly was denied admission to the University of North Carolina in 1938, wrote a letter to FDR protesting his characterization of the University of North Carolina as a liberal bastion and taking him to task for not supporting anti-lynching legislation. That letter led to Eleanor Roosevelt reaching out to Polly, and Polly then became a very good friend of Eleanor Roosevelt's. In most importantly, Polly in 1943 wrote a thesis that really challenged the prevailing acceptance of Plessy v. Ferguson, separate but equal. This even NAACP lawyers at the time were fighting for more equal, to try to get equal schools and equal treatment. And yet it was Polly who said, wait a minute, if they're separate, there is no equal. And she predicted that Plessy v. Ferguson would be overturned. At the time, her classmates and her professor laughed at her. And yet that very same professor told Polly that when Thurgood Marshall, just 10 years later, was preparing for the Brown v. Board of Education suit, that he and others relied on Polly's thinking about separate but equal. So that's an amazing contribution to have influenced Thurgood Marshall and RBG.
And how did you put the documentary together? I mean, she was a very voluminous writer, and I'm curious about the materials that you worked with, the access to people willing to talk about Polly. How did that all come together?
Yeah, when Julie and I first had this idea, we really didn't know if we could make a documentary about someone who had died almost 35 years before. And yet it was Polly, frankly, who made this possible, because despite lack of sufficient recognition in their lifetime, Polly really had a sense of history and saved everything. And when I say everything, I mean 141 boxes of material dating way back to Polly's childhood and coming of age in the Depression. Unbelievable letters and diary entries and photographs, even more than the pictures were the audio tapes. There were about 40 hours worth of audio interviews in the Schlesinger Library at Harvard.
And so what do you think is the value in this moment in our history and culture of producing a documentary on Polly's life and story? What lessons do you think today's audience can learn from Polly's experiences that apply to the challenges we're facing today?
It's an extraordinary and thrilling life, a person who faced so many challenges and setbacks and yet seemed to always find a way to think outside of the box and to get around those challenges. Polly had a very strong sense that the battles Polly was fighting for labor rights and civil rights and women's rights were all connected. These were all fights for human rights. In this era where we understand that there's just so much work to be done for gender equality, for LGBTQ equality, and for civil rights, that Polly's approach of reconciliation and coming together is one to consider. You know, even though Polly was not publicly identified as queer at the time, Polly has become a beacon for the LGBTQ community, and Polly's work definitely influenced the most recent Supreme Court ruling for equality for LGBTQ people in employment. So I think that Polly's legacy goes on and is part of a larger movement to reconsider the way we tell our history. Why weren't we taught about Polly Murray? Who else weren't we taught about? What other systems were we not adequately thinking about? I mean, it's all part of a greater picture of reconsideration of how we tell stories about the past.
Well, it's a remarkable film. I definitely urge listeners to check it out. And so if they want to watch the film, where can they do so?
People can see the documentary, My Name is Polly Murray, streaming on Amazon Prime as of October 1st.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us, Betsy West, co-director of the new documentary, My Name is Polly Murray.
Well, thanks to Ethan Elkind for that wonderful interview. And that's State of the Bay for this week. I want to thank all our guests and listeners this evening for being part of the conversation. Next Monday, we'll find out how the new Texas abortion law affects or might mean changes for California. And if you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, or to send us a message about next week's topics, you can email us anytime at stateofthebay@kalw.org. For a link to this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page at kalw.org. Tonight's show was produced by Jillian Emblad and Kendra Klang. It was engineered by David Kwan, and D Minor was our board operator. For Ethan Elkind and Grace Swan, I'm Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night, and have a great week.